Here comes the sun, little darling. Here comes the sun. I say it's alright.
So, hey everybody, this is Eric Mann. You're listening to Voices from the Front Lines, your international rebuilding show. You know, we used to call it Voices from the Front Lines. Then I changed it to Voices from the Front Lines, your national movement building show. And having been in Bonn, Germany, and I'll get to discussing the problems with the Germans, and Paris, France, and I'm going to tell you a lot of problems with the white French, but I've been very deeply moved in talking to especially the brothers and sisters from Africa, and also from the Philippines and from Asia and from Latin America, to make me understand that Voices has a tremendous potential to be an international building show. And one of the goals of the show, increasingly in my own consciousness, is to allow, since they're saying voices from the front lines, is to get the voices of people from Asia, Africa, and Latin America on our show, because the politics of voices increasingly is about U.S. imperialism and what are we going to do about the United States. And what we mean by what are we going to do about the United States, we don't mean how we in the United States are going to figure out what to do about the United States. That's the kind of Occupy line, which is we're all in the United States and there's a 1% and there's a 99%. No, the United States is the greater oppressor of people all over the world. And when we talk about what are we going to do about the United States, I mean what is the world going to do about the United States. That's the we. So in this context, the first thing you're going to listen to is my friend and colleague, Barbara Lott Hollins, who's also the Associate Director of the Strategy Center. And Barbara and I have been working very hard to try to even understand this whole United Nations process. And as I'm going to tell you in my overall introduction, this whole United Nations process is filled with such lies, such terrible, terrible, dishonest formulations. It's not like a bad treaty. It's like a treaty that doesn't want to be a treaty. It's like people writing things that they know aren't going to happen. And I'm going to get into that. So you're going to hear Barbara's article about the Green Climate Fund and why the United States and President Obama should deposit immediately $100 billion in that fund. And as a writer and as somebody who has relative facility with writing, except that I know it's darn hard. I still do draft after draft. It's been a pleasure to work with Barbara on her article and to watch her grow as a writer and grow in her confidence and grow in her research. And you're about to hear Barbara Hone in her second or third or fourth article, but you're going to be hearing a lot more of her on Voices and you're going to be reading a lot more of her article. After Barbara, we're going to hear some more, and Nina is in many ways the glue of the music of this show. And then I'm going to get a commentary first about trying to understand the seriousness of the climate negotiations at the United Nations and six or seven of the key issues. Then I'm going to hear some more Nina Simone, and then I'm going to do a commentary on how can we save the Paris Climate Justice March from the French, and how can we keep the French out of Paris so they don't mess up the march. So with that, you're going to listen to Barbara Lott Hollins, and I'll talk to you soon.
Hello, everyone. This is Barbara Lott Hollins, Associate Director at the Labor Community Strategy Center and our campaign, Fight for the Soul of the Cities. I have been in Bonn at the prep cons for COP21, sitting in, listening at the negotiations and talking with NGOs and civil society and organizers from around the world. And one of the things that has captured me is the Green Climate Fund and the emphasis on loss and damages. So I've wrote a piece and I would like to share it with you at this time. The title of my piece is President Obama, You Must Deposit $100 Billion into the Green Climate Fund now for the loss and damages and reparations to the nations and the peoples of Africa, Asia, and Latin America suffering from U.S. climate. In 2011, the United Nations established a Green Climate Fund to move at least $100 billion to the third world and oppressed nations to allow them to move toward non-polluting economies, while the capitalist North work to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. As Dr. King said, the United States is the greatest purveyor of violence in the world, and also now is seen as the greatest polluter in the world. It has a moral and a political obligation to pay the entire $100 billion and then some. But guess what? The U.S. has only pledged $3 billion. And how much do you think they've paid so far? Absolutely nothing. The Native Americans taught me about the broken promises of the U.S. government. And again, as Dr. King observed at the March on Washington, the U.S. has made promises to the black people that come back marked insufficient funds. But these funds must be paid, and paid now. The United States has a military budget of more than $600 billion, and they must deposit $100 billion of that immediately into the Green Climate Fund. Our fight for the souls of the cities is building a movement in the United States to demand that President Obama reduce U.S. greenhouse gases by at least 50% of the 1999 levels by 2025, and starting now. I'm in Bonn, Germany, with the Strategy Center's director, Eric Mann, and we're trying to open up more spaces for black-centered, anti-U.S. imperialistic perspective on climate change and calling the question, what are you going to do about the United States? So please see Eric Mann's companion article with that same name. Now, after a week of work with other NGOs and leaders of the social movement, especially in the third world, we've added another central demand to our platform, that the United States must deposit $100 billion into the Green Climate Fund now. This Green Climate Fund has intrigued me from the day I got here. Obviously, we want to change every element of U.S. policy, but since I strongly believe in the concept of reparations, and in this case, U.S. climate reparations to the oppressed nations inside and outside the U.S., I was very excited to learn more about this big piece of the puzzle. So let me tell you what I've learned so far. The forthcoming Paris United Nations Framework Climate Change Conference is also called COP21. Yes, ironic that the UN is calling the cops on us. But really, in this case, it means something different. It's the Conference of the Parties, which means that governments have been meeting on climate since 1995. Thus, the first year was called COP1, and each year it goes up. So now we in 2015, and it's called COP21. At COP16 in Cancun, the UN set up the Green Climate Fund. Now, let me use the exact language of the UN statement. The parties establish a Green Climate Fund, also known as GCF, as an operating entity of the financial mechanism of the convention under Article 21, end of quote. So the GC will support programs, projects, policies, and other activities in developing countries' parties. This fund is governed by a GCF board of 24 members, equally divided between developing and developed countries. It's headquartered in Seoul, South Korea, and the interim trustee is the World Bank. So this GCF will have thematic funding window for adaptation, mitigation, as well as a separate private sector facility. Obviously, that's a lot to comprehend, but as they say, and starting with myself, let me try and break it down for all of us. One thing I'm learning is that the United Nations makes a lot of good statements, but because it's dominated by the United States and the European Union, the actual policies are usually very bad. But there are several alternative blocks. The main one is called the G77 and China, which is 34 world countries. And it's important to note that China is considered to be so powerful, it must have its name mentioned. This is important because we're looking for forces counter to the United States to open up a space for organizing. There's also a very important association of small states, nations whose entire existence is threatened by the rising waters, droughts, flood, rising sea levels, created by global warming from the United States and Europe. When I heard that the United Nations was going to give $100 billion to nations of the third world, I was very excited, only to find out that that's not really true. Okay, so what are we looking at? The Green Climate Fund was discussed in Copenhagen Accords, COP15, in 2009. It was formally established in Cancun, COP16, 2010. Then the governing body was adopted in Durban, COP17, in 2011. And yet, of this $100 billion promise, which some of the largest countries, the U.S. had promised $3 billion, Japan promised $1.5 billion, the U.K. promised $1.2 billion, Germany promised $4 billion, Sweden $580 million, Italy $313 million, but only $5.5 billion has been deposited. Japan has already deposited its $1.5 billion. Germany has deposited $1 billion of its $4 billion pledge. The U.S., zero deposited. And at the annual meeting of the board of the Green Climate Fund, the developing nations, the oppressor countries, officially agreed to raise the $100 billion by 2020. The Green Climate Fund was created to assist third world countries to reduce emissions and to reduce the worst impacts of climate change. The GC Fund is not currently a binding document, but we are all hoping that it becomes binding at the Paris Convention at COP21. Now, I've learned that the plan is for the primary polluters countries, called the developing countries, have actually, in fact, only pledged $10 billion with the plan to mobilize money from the private sector, which we can expect to be from big polluters trying to cover up their policies. But again, none of this is definite, enforceable, or real. So given that we want to shift the terms of the debate, I think our climate justice movement should support the demand that the United States alone contribute $100 billion cash now into the Green Climate Fund, which in turn would be used for direct grants to government and organizations in the third world for what is called loss and damages from the extreme weather events and technological transfer that would allow the transferring of the most advanced fuel efficiency or zero emission technology to these countries. You know, the U.S. military budget is over $600 billion, and the U.S. Senate just voted in favor of $8 billion for an oil pipeline from Alberta, Canada, to the U.S. In that situation, $100 million is both justified and possible. From what I understand, the U.S. and the EU have been fighting tooth and nail to keep out any language about loss and damages because they do not want to pay for the past climate abuses. And they want to say, we can all just start now. But that is, of course, because, as with reparations from the transatlantic slave trade, Europe and the U.S. do not want to talk about their role. This demand calls that question. As a working class woman of the black nation from South Central Los Angeles, I understand the importance of the effect that this omission has on the lives of the most vulnerable, oppressed people all over the world, including my own people in Los Angeles, Africa, and throughout the black diaspora. 10 years after Hurricane Katrina, more than 100 black people are still struggling with their right to return. In many black families in New Orleans, families' homes, histories, and cultures have been lost. I see this as a form of forced migration, and the U.S. is using extreme weather conditions to try and justify whole communities being gentrified, over-policed, and criminalized when black people try to fight for their land and their history. I have been telling people in the black and Latino communities in Los Angeles and anywhere I go that we better take climate change very seriously, because we are on the front line of the destruction and devastation. So we need to be on the front lines of the resistance. We are the first to go and the last of all, if at all, to be reparated and repaired. I also recognize that my responsibility to help lead the call for what are we going to do about the United States, and to do it from a black climate justice and imperialistic perspective. When I represented the Strategy Center at the World Summit on Sustainable Development in Johannesburg, South Africa in 2002, I played an active role in the women's tent. And in that women's tent, it was led by many third world women. I was struck by both the wonderful crafts and their micro enterprises, small businesses. The women had organized, but I was also aware that some of the women were trying to put forth sustainable economic development without calling out the U.S. and Europe as their oppressors. And when I started talking about the U.S. as an oppressor and black people as an oppressed nation, people there were both shocked and happy. I mean, not shocked that they were oppressed third world people, but shocked that people, especially from the U.S., would say that openly. That was the first time that I really understood how much the United States is dominating the United Nations and threatening any nation and people who even use the terms that challenge them morally and politically. I also realized that the Strategy Center and people in the U.S. have a real opportunity to stand up to our own government in these spaces, and how much the people in the third world appreciate it, which in fact, that's the least that we could do, really. Finally, I am so grateful to the new friends I am making from Asia, Latin America, and especially Africa, where I feel my roots, my soul, and my politics give me new energy as I am moving to call out my own government using terms like reparation, black nation, climate abuse, loss and damages, and imperialism. I've received a great deal of support from my sisters and brothers in the third world who have said it means a lot when you call the question out about what are you going to do about the United States. But I've also been told by some of my European colleagues that I don't understand how delicate the situation is about the UN document and how certain statements might hurt our cause. And I have to explain back that I know what I'm doing and I know what I'm saying. And I solidly appreciate a little less advice and a lot more support as I have been receiving from my sisters and brothers in the third world. So, as they say, in conclusion, the Strategy Center and our fight for the soul of the city is calling the question, has called the question, what are we going to do about the United States? President Obama, cut U.S. greenhouse gas emissions by 50% from 1990 levels by 2025, starting now. Front-loaded, verifiable, enforceable. President Obama, deposit $100 billion into the Green Climate Fund now. Open borders and amnesty for immigrants in the United States. Stop U.S. drone attacks. No cars in L.A. and in the U.S. No tanks in L.A. and in the U.S. Full support and priority for the loss and damage, reparations to the nations and people of the Third World inside and outside the U.S. Self-determination for the black nation, up to and including the right to secede from the United States. End U.S. drone attacks. Build the people's movement from climate justice to Paris and beyond. Thank you very much. This is Barbara Lott Holland, Associate Director of the Labor Community Strategy Center's Fight for the Soul of the Cities. See you in the streets.
So you've just heard Barbara Lott Holland finishing up her article. This is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Front Lines, your international movement building show. You're on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and streaming live on the web at kpfk.org. And in talking to people in the Third World in particular, they're very excited about streaming live on the web and being able to tell their stories to an international audience. So we're going to listen to some more Nina Simone, and I'll be right back to talk about trying to unpack, unravel, comprehend what the heck are the debates going on at the United Nations itself about the actual document that they're trying to agree upon in December 2015 in Paris. And also tell you that I will be back in Paris, as will Barbara Lott Holland and several other people. But your Voices from the Front Lines team is going to be reporting a lot from the Paris United Nations Framework Climate Change Conference from December 1st to December 15th, 2015. Since the Labor Community Strategy Center, of which I'm director, made a major commitment to the Paris United Nations Framework Climate Change Conference, I have been working really, really hard to dig into the documents of what's hopefully going to be an international agreement on climate change. The stakes are beyond enormous. It is impossible to comprehend droughts and floods. It's impossible to comprehend tornadoes. It's impossible to comprehend extreme weather events, entire islands going under because of the warming of the oceans, the destruction of coral reefs, the destruction of simple food gathering processes. We met someone named Hindu, who's an organizer, and she's with a tribe that is based in both Chad and South Africa, and her tribe covers five different African nations, and their main job right now as a nomadic people is simply trying to find water in order to be able to live. It's been very helpful to me because I'm deeply moved by the crisis of environment inside the United States, and obviously I have a new version of my book coming out, Katrina's Legacy, which is an analysis of the climate crimes of the United States in New Orleans. It's still beyond comprehension that if the Earth has warmed so far at 8/10 of a degree, that's less than 1 degree since 1850, that 8/10 of a degree has caused a level of drought and flood, extreme weather events, salinization of water, which means it's not drinkable, destruction of food cycles. One country was saying that they used to have four seasons, they now have two, an extreme winter and extreme summer. Human beings are destroying the planet, and specifically the organization of human beings into systems, of which capitalism is the worst. And unfortunately, all of the systems are having a heck of a time coming to terms with what are we going to do about humans' relationship to the planet. I've been sort of staying up all night for months trying to understand, because I take very seriously the words in treaties and contracts, and it matters. For a lot of KPFK listeners, frankly, I don't think you engage enough. Like you say, well, the system's no good, so I don't need to read this bill. Yes, you do. People are fighting over a specific bill. And it may be a terrible bill, but aren't you even interested in what the bill says before you decide that it's terrible or good? And more importantly, how do we struggle with the capitalists or the ruling class when, in fact, contracts and laws and statements, even if they're violated, even if the system doesn't take them seriously, other people do. So I've been dealing with this fascinating document called the Ad Hoc Working Group on the Durban Platform for Enhanced Action. Second session, part 8, 8 to 13, February 2015, Geneva, Switzerland. Work of the Contact Group on Item 3, Negotiating Text, Advanced Unedited Version, 12 February 2015. Fascinating, huh? It's really getting you excited. But they purposely do it. They write it in this way that nobody knows. You can barely get through the title, let alone the content. But I have been studying it. I've been reading it. And then I've been in Bonn, Germany, where the United Nations met for the last 2 weeks to try to make progress towards a final agreement. So you got to understand, you got to just, it's mind-blowing to try to figure out how this works. The first thing to understand is that this document, which should have been already pretty much ready, is almost like a multiple choice test in which every single statement has four options for it. A, B, C, and D. So it says like option A, it's going to help present and future generations of humankind. Option B, option C, option D. And often what really is behind these options is sort of like, number one, we're really going to get rid of fossil fuels. Number two, perhaps we're going to get rid of fossil fuels. Number three, maybe sometime we're going to get rid of fossil fuels. And option four, we're not going to get rid of fossil fuels. So you have to sit there and understand that they are so strongly disagreeing with each other that they can't even get language yet. So when we got to Bonn, thinking that there was going to be real progress among the governments, for 10 days, what they were discussing is how to condense this 80-page document into 40 pages. If the world wasn't coming to an end, this would be pretty funny. It could be sitcom. Because for 2 weeks, thousands and thousands of people in Bonn, Germany, all being paid very well by the government, sitting around, going from meeting after meeting, and they're not even yet negotiating over the text, but they're negotiating over how to edit the text down so it's clear enough to be negotiated. Does that make any sense? So basically, I'm thinking, am I in Bonn, Germany? Am I losing my mind? Is this a really bad movie? That the world is coming to an end, I mean that. And we are now in June. You have a document that's due in December, and you still are not negotiating over what it's going to say, but you're negotiating over how to edit it. It has a very surreal nature to it. But let me tell you, having studied it for a while, well, at least some of the issues that are at stake are, and that we in the United States and we at the Labor Community Strategy Center have to get you, KPFK listeners, to take very seriously, because I am going to be coming back to the United States very soon from Paris to organize a series of meetings to walk over this text with people so we can just begin to get our heads around it. What is at stake? I've been outlining for my own comprehension. Let me tell you what some of the issues are. The first is that, are we fighting for 1.5 degrees Celsius increase or 2.0 degrees Celsius? The reason why this is important is that the UN document is saying, what are we going to do to stop and create enough policy so that the Earth does not increase 2 degrees Celsius over the 1850 beginning of measuring, when the so-called Industrial Revolution began to generate so much fossil fuel that it did begin to warm the planet. The first problem with that is the third world and the third world and the third world, which is central to my understanding, is saying we cannot agree on a 2% target. We have to agree on a 1.5 degree target because we're already at 8/10 of a degree, which means it's going to double. If it gets to 1.6, which is twice of 0.8, that means that's going to be twice as hot as it is now. That's mind-blowing. And the West is really saying it's gone. A lot of people are saying privately, 1.5 is not even scientifically possible because of all the heat that's in the pipeline. Other people are saying 2% is not really possible because nobody is doing anything. The level of small changes, when we're saying the only way you can cut emissions is we're asking President Obama, cut U.S. emissions by 50% of 1990 levels starting now. And it's going to be hard as heck to develop a movement around that. But that's my goal, and that's our goal, is at least can we agree on what the demand is. The second factual issue that's being debated is what is your baseline? You know, what level are we trying to reduce from? So, for instance, at the Strategy Center, we've been making the demand, President Obama, reduce emissions from 1990 levels. But when you read all the stuff in these documents, some are talking about 2000 levels, some are talking about 2005 levels. Well, what's the difference? The difference is it was less hot in 1990 than it is in 2005. So if you're using 2005 levels that you're trying to cut, you're already at a higher baseline, which means you're going to cut less in order to make that number. We have to go back to 1990 levels, and some people are saying that the 50% level is not enough. We have to be talking 70%, 80% cuts. So when we say 50%, God forbid if the Strategy Center ever was moderate. That's my worst word. But the 50% above 1990 levels is very radical. And we do not have a consensus. We do not have a movement in the United States that even understands the differences. And we're going to do everything we can to work with the mainstream environmental groups, to elected officials, but mainly to people in South LA and East LA, to grasp these are life and death numbers. You can learn this science. It matters. We have to learn it, and we have to demand it 50% now. The next thing, which is really scary, because I've been going to these NGO, non-governmental organization meetings, and I don't know how, but I've been getting into these meetings with the head of security for the United Nations. We met with, and I'm sorry I did not write her name down for here, a woman who is the leading environmental advisor to the French government, which is hosting this conference. And we did have a pretty interesting conversation. I mean, you have to understand our job is just to meet with everybody and be friendly and talk and make everybody feel happy. And we were trying to talk to her about different issues. And of course, very frankly, you know, she's shining us on. You know, I mean, this is her job. She's a very intelligent woman. And there was some very important stuff she said. But everybody talked, and I said, I want to ask you one question. Well, let me go back a step. This is important. What she said that was interesting is that at the United Nations now, they're calling it INDCs, which is Intended Nationally Determined Contributions. So let's, I'm sorry, it's language, you just got to, one flew over the cuckoo's nest or something. Intended, that means that in Paris, every government is free to set whatever number it wants. If it intends to do nothing, it's free to do that. Unlike Kyoto that had some minor cuts, but we're trying to make it enforceable. This doesn't even pretend to be enforceable. So the first thing is rather strange to say, you're intended. Then nationally determined, meaning that every country is free to set its own limit. So if the United States wants to say it wants to cut 10%, and China says it wants to cut 4%, if people say, I want to start, and a lot of them, this is important, want to start, they want to start in 2020, they want to start in 2030, then what's the point? If there's no standard that everybody is held to. Now, the woman made a very interesting point. She said, well, look, I am aware of the limits of this methodology. But here's my problem. You can't force these governments to do it. The United Nations is not strong enough. So by asking each country to come up with a number, frankly, we're trying to use shame and persuasion. If country A sets a higher number than country B, theoretically they're going to be more prestigious. Country B is going to look bad. It's going to be subject to public opinion. If we can win a lot of public opinion around climate. So I said, well, I have a different question. How do you determine if the country made its number? If the United States says it's going to cut emissions by 28%, and I say they should cut it by 50%, how do you know they're going to be cut by 28%? And I don't know if you know if I'm going to get to the other story about my fight with the French racists, but I'm getting very good at being ignored. I mean, Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man is pretty funny because she answered everybody's question but mine, because, of course, I raised the best question. But really, I did, because everything else, what do you think about this? And I said, can you even measure whether or not the countries are meeting their goals? And she couldn't answer that. So the point I'm getting to is, if she was saying, and this is Eric Mann, you're on Voices from the Frontlines, KPFK, 90.7 FM, in Los Angeles. If she was saying we want to embarrass the countries and we want to praise the countries that do better, and I'm saying how do you even measure if they made their goals, and she couldn't answer that, this is scary, scary stuff. So first it's voluntary, it's intended, and worst of all, you can't even measure it. All right, so then we move to another concept. The Green Climate Fund, which Barbara talked about, is another classic thing. First we thought, oh great, it's $100 billion. Well no, actually it's not $100 billion, it's trying to raise $100 billion, and then it's trying to raise $100 billion by 2020. No, actually, it's trying to mobilize $100 billion. Scary stuff. I mean, let's understand something. When the United States wanted to invade Iraq, it invaded Iraq. When the United States wanted to lock up prisoners, there were 200,000 prisoners. When I was into the Civil Rights Movement in 1964-68, there's now 2.5 million real prisoners. The United States knows how to make its numbers when it wants to kill people. When the United States wanted to kill 4 million people in Vietnam through napalm, Agent Orange, defoliation, torture, rape, murder, it met its numbers. So the United States knows how to make its numbers. It knows what a government has to do when it wants to do something. And it's terrible that the United States is really good at genocide and really bad at the most minimum efforts to control its own emissions. The next thing that's really scary is this concept of loss and damages. Loss and damages means that a lot of the people in the third world are pushing very, very hard for the concept of loss and damages, meaning there's already been climate crimes, there's already been climate devastation. You must pay us back for the extreme weather events. You must pay us back that Tuvalu is already almost underwater. You must pay us back that a typhoon in the Philippines every year. But they've always had typhoons in the Philippines. That's not the problem. The problem is the level of the typhoons over the last 6, 7, 8, 10, 15 years is, again, at a totally different level. So the third world is paying loss and damages, and guess what? The European Union and the United States are saying we will not even let the concept of loss and damages be in the text. They've taken it out, and they've only talked about what's called mitigation and adaptation. I'll come back to that in a minute. But let's get to the point. We're not talking about mitigation. We're not talking about adaptation. We're talking about reparations. And we're also talking about virtually zero emissions now. Those two questions are at the core. Cutting emissions to zero now, starting with 50%, enforceable, and reparations to the people of the third world. And there's another concept you have to understand. And that's called technology transfer. What the third world is saying is that you guys, as bad as you are developing more fuel-efficient cars, are developing more fuel-efficient buses, you are developing lower-emission pollution, and we are stuck, we in the third world, that is, with the worst technology, the oldest equipment, the most polluting. And you're telling us that we're supposed to reduce our emissions, but we have no money to even feed our people. So you must give us, back to Barbara's article, like give up $100 billion, and the specific form that could take is what's called technology transfer, which is you must give us the least polluting equipment. And here's something else that I've learned, that, you know, all this talk about getting rid of coal, which is the dirtiest, filthiest fuel, even though the coal industry in the United States is complaining, and the coal miners, sadly, are complaining, they're very tied to the pollution, the truth is that the West is getting out of coal. And one reason it's getting out of coal is because it's getting into fracking and oil and even talking about nuclear. But which and who are the people who are most dependent on coal? The third world. So all this talk about dirty coal, filthy coal, let's get out of coal. The people in the third world say, we want to get out of coal, but we are a coal-based energy system, and you are not giving us the technology to get out of coal. Whoa. So I hope you can hear, as I'm talking, I'm telling you what I'm going through. One is, very frankly, I am learning this stuff. It feels exciting. I'm getting it. If you stick to 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 or 12 main points, and you listen carefully, and if you talk to the people in the third world who are the smartest, not inherently the smartest, they're the smartest because of their whole historical development under the oppression of imperialism, their contempt for the French, their contempt for the British, their contempt for the United States, is pretty biting. And on the other hand, that contempt comes from centuries of colonization and centuries of barbarism on the part of the West. And it's a historically determined intelligence. It's a historically determined humanity, because the Third World has spent its entire life struggling against the inhumanity of the West. So if you're interested, send me emails at eric@voicesfromthefrontlines.com, eric@voicesfromthefrontlines.com. And if you want to come to events that I'm going to be organizing and the Strategy Center is going to be organizing to get you aware of this, so we can put pressure on the no cars in L.A. and the United States, no tanks in L.A. and the United States, please see my Huffington Post article about this. We need people in Los Angeles to become part of an international climate justice movement that prioritizes the needs and the peoples of the third world, both inside and outside the United States. So this is Eric Mann. I'm the host of Voices from the Frontlines, your international movement building show. Deeply moved. I'm in Paris, but I'm mainly, my mind and heart and soul are in the third world. And I'm in Paris meeting with, in particular, Africans from Cameroon, from South Africa, from Chad, from Gabon. I gotta relearn, just like I'm learning my science, I gotta relearn my African history, my African geography. And it's a pleasure. Barbara Lott Holland has been spending the last 10 days, both in Bonn, Germany, and in Paris, two imperialist cities, mainly talking to third world scientists, organizers, and activists, learning a lot. And we're trying to keep the question of what are we going to do and what is the world going to do about the United States. So we're going to take a break. We'll hear another round of Nina Simone. And in what few minutes I got left, I'll start my tirade about the French, which I will continue as I think about it and write about it. This is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines. Let's hear some Nina, and we'll be right back.
There'll be no strings to bind your hands. Not if my love can't bind your heart. And there's no need to take a stand, for it was I who chose to start. No need to take me home.
So hey everybody, welcome back. You're on Voices from the Frontlines, your international movement building show. This is your host, Eric Mann. I'm in Paris. As I ended, and I'm still saying I'm in Paris physically, but my mind is in Africa right now. And I'm just trying desperately to figure out what we in the United States can do to help black people in the United States, Latino people in the United States, indigenous people in the United States, or working class people in the United States, but mainly what we can do to stop our own government being not just the greatest purveyor of violence in the world, but now the greatest polluter in the world, and even worse, the policeman against people that are really trying to reduce emissions. That is to say, it's not just the United States. It's failing to really meet its own target, but President Obama is throwing his weight around in Paris through the State Department, through the United Nations staff, to threaten the nations of the third world to say, you be very careful. Do not push the European Union, the United States, and the Just Cans group, which is Japan, U.S., Canada, Australia, New Zealand. Do not push us very hard, because number one, we don't plan to do very much. So if you push us very hard, it's going to make us look bad. And since we have the CIA, and since we have 800 military bases all over the world, you better be very careful in Paris. And you know what? The governments are. It's scary. You talk about a world police force of intellectual thought, the United States is the greatest purveyor of censorship in the world as well. I don't even know how I can begin to tell you what it was like to go into a room of, now we're in Paris, okay? We've been in Bonn, we fought our way through all the double talk, triple talk, quadruple talk, and we go to Paris for the so-called social movements meeting, and we're very excited about it. There's 400 people going to come to plan the event, and 300 of them are from France. Almost all of them are white. There may be 15 Africans there, maybe 10 people from Asia. I'll say maybe 10 from Latin America. So 80-85% white, but more importantly, the role of white, European, Christian, capitalist hegemony, cultural hegemony in that room was shocking to me. Now, I'm a Jew who has spent 50 years of my life in the black movement and in the black community. Because I've been one of the few Jews, or occasionally white people, which I don't really identify as, inside the black movement, we have just taken for granted our anger at white folks, white culture, white supremacy, white chauvinism, white society, the white man, the white power structure. We hate whiteness. But interestingly, a significant number of white people have been won over in the United States to grasp at least something is wrong with white society. And a significant number of young white people don't really want to be part of that dominant society. They don't like it either. On the most positive level, we have to understand that when President Obama ran for president, Barack Hussein Obama, as a peace candidate, as a race candidate, as a gay candidate, as an environmental candidate, as a gay and lesbian candidate, as the women's candidate, as all the things that the white right hates, he got over 50% of the vote of young white people from 18 to 29. I say this because as much as I've been so angry about white culture and white society, it is nothing like seeing the white liberals in Paris, who I think are just disgraceful. And I'm trying to be careful because I'm going to write a lot about this, but these people are even more dangerous because they have so few. They have not grown up in a culture of blacks and Latinos because they have mainly exported the oppression of blacks and Latinos into the third world. But we know over the last 20, 30, 40, and 50 years there's been massive migration of immigrants into France, into Germany. And this is changing a lot because these are, of course, the people from the colonized nations. And I'm trying to learn more about this. But to understand that the immigration issues are coming from the crisis in the third world produced by Europe and the United States. And there are many, 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 many more people in France than they will acknowledge, who are Algerians, who are Africans, who are Muslims, who are from the Middle East, from Asia. And yet they were not reflected at this conference. So let me ask you a question here. We're trying to build an international movement on climate change. We're in Paris, France. If the Strategy Center was running that event, and people like us in France, if there was such a thing, that room would be 80% African, Algerian, immigrant, with, of course, some white people, but it would not be a dominant white culture. What scared the hell out of me is these French, which is always the case in these all-white contexts, they're real happy there. They don't even seem to notice. And they're all proud about this demonstration they're going to have in Paris on November 28th and November 29th. And I started playing a role. And imagine you're in a room of 50 white people, and I'm maybe the only Jew. And as a Jew, I'm increasingly understanding that I don't like white people in general, but also they don't like me. You know, they don't like Jews, and they don't like blacks, and they don't like Latinos. I'm not, you know, and I'm more in some ways understanding that, like I just heard something that's mind-blowing to me. We know 1492 was the year of the genocide. I just read today, which may be super obvious, in 1492, the Spanish drove out the Sephardic Jews from Spain. So, I mean, not 1491, not 1493, 1492 was the expulsion of the Jews and the invasion of the indigenous peoples. So I'm doing some more work in my head about the relationship of Jews to the third world, and certainly understanding how disliked I am by most white people, and it's mutual. So there I am in this meeting, and I'm trying to fight for people in the third world, and I'm raising all these questions about racism, about why are there no more black people there, about why are we not talking about immigration. And they went around and around, and I stood up and challenged the whole room. There was one woman from Africa there. And when I finished, I was waiting for somebody to take me on, and they went, I think we should use blue banners. No, I think it should be on Wednesday. No, I think we should have hot chocolate. It was like I hadn't spoken. So I had a second time. I got up and said, look, I'm a pretty big person. But I was sitting, so let me stand. You guys, you think French is great, but you are the ones who have murdered the people in Africa. You passed your own French Revolution, but then you did not let Toussaint Louverture in Haiti, when they had the first slave, the black slave, republic. You went into Haiti, invaded it, imposed enormous reparations to France. So don't think they don't believe in reparations, because they wanted Haiti to pay France back, and then they kidnapped Toussaint Louverture and he died in a French prison. I said, you're the guys who lost World War II to the Nazis. You're the ones who collaborated with the Nazis. I'm doing anything I can to shake these people up. And I think, okay, I really nailed it. And they go, well, were you saying a red or a blue banner? Were you saying, so afterwards, I'm like picking for a fight, you know, I'm also, there are some group dynamics that are pretty strange. There was one African woman and me in this room on one side and 49 white Christian French on the other. So the woman said, from Africa, we're bringing a faith delegation from Africa to this demonstration. And the woman from one of the mainstream groups said, very good, well, whenever you come, we'll accommodate you. As if she was being nice. Instead of saying, wait a minute, real Africans are coming. What can we do to help? And it turns out that they have tremendous financial problems just getting people here. So I'm going to talk about this more next week, but here was the last one. In an effort, to think he was doing something good, this white guy said, this white Frenchman said, we must remember the people who will not be in Paris from the third world. And so what I suggest is to make these people real. We should take a picture of them, and each of us should carry the picture. So imagine, he's saying, 300,000 white people should be carrying the picture of 300,000 black people. Not having any black people there, but carrying a picture. So finally, I met with this woman who I'm going to take on an article, very influential French organizer. And I said to her, well, you know, we're planning to bring a very large delegation of blacks and Latinos to Paris. And I'm very, very concerned about this racism. And folks, you're not going to believe this is true. The leader of the French environmental movement said, I don't think it's good to bring too many of them because you're going to be burning too much fossil fuel. If I have to agitate you on this, then you got a problem. This is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Front Lines. Feel my rage. Controlled burn. Your international movement building show. This is super exciting stuff. We're coming back to L.A. with a great deal of rage, a great deal of wisdom that we got. And as the Algerian speaker said to the group in France, you all think that you're civilized and we're barbarians, but you're the barbarians, and you're the ones who have something to learn from us. This is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Front Lines, your international movement building show. As I end every show, and as it never gets old, all power to the people. And Nina Simone, I did it my way. See you next Tuesday at 4.
Now, the end is near, and so I've got to face the final curtain. Friends, I've stayed clear and staked my case, of which I'm certain. I've lived a life that's full. I've traveled each and every highway and more, much more than this.